From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Later tonight, Dr. Michael Sala joins us. Project Looking Glass. Here's what's happening. A transcontinental storm system that wreaked havoc on Thanksgiving travel has made a mess Monday for the millions returning to work in the Northeast, snarling air traffic, closing schools and government offices across the region. Wow, it's been a rough one. A swarm of at least 15 little earthquakes reaching up to 2.3 magnitude rattling Ridgely, Tennessee, which is a small town near the Mississippi River, over a two-day period. Other quakes in the swarm ranged from 2.1 to 1.5 magnitude, according to the USGS. What's happening over there? Do you like French fries? Well, potato processors are rushing to buy supplies and ship them across North America in order to keep French fries on the menu after cold, wet weather damaged crops and key producers in the U.S. and Canada. The cool conditions started to hit growing regions in October, lashing potatoes with frost. Farmers in Alberta, Canada, and Idaho were able to dig up some of the damaged crops for storage, but growers in Manitoba, North Dakota, Minnesota received snow and rain, forcing them to abandon some supplies in the fields. Democratic lawmakers in Congress will take a big step this week in what appears to be now a march toward impeaching U.S. President Donald Trump, with the start of hearings seen as a precursor to a formal charges being announced within weeks. Now, just so you understand the process, if he is impeached, it means it goes to trial in the Senate, and that's where they have to convict him. Impeachment doesn't mean you're out. It means it gets into a trial stage. 6 in 10 Americans said at the beginning of 2019 that this would be the year they finally get in shape, according to a recent survey. Yet 2 in 5 respondents, now 40%, now admit they feel that they're too old to get back in the gym. In fact, a survey of 2,000 adults found that, on average, the age when most in the survey felt too old to work out regularly was just, get this, 41 years old. That's it. As I reported last night on the show, almost a quarter of the young people are so dependent on their smartphones that it becomes an addiction, according to psychiatrists. The study from King's College in London says such addictive behavior means that people become panicky or upset if they are denied constant access. I thought we'd bring in our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Bregan, to talk about this. Peter, they get attached to it, but I think adults get all, you know, shaken when they don't get their phones, too.
You know, George, that's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, it's ridiculous. Imagine if these researchers didn't have their phones. There's so many things wrong with it. For one thing, it's not an addiction. It's not a pill. It's not changing you in a physiological way, making you dependent on it. It's a way of communicating with people. And if you pull that communication plug on people, of course it's going to upset them. I'm surprised that there was just one quarter of the people.
I thought it would be higher, actually.
Yeah, I would think it would be higher for the kids. And, you know, my high school and college-age patients, George, they love texting me. They think it makes me cool, and it makes them feel closer to me.
Well, you know, it's easier too, Peter, than a phone call. If I took as many phone calls as I do text messages during the day, I'd never get anything done.
Well, you know, I hadn't thought of that, George, but I think that's absolutely right. And you get it done at your own leisure, and you have plenty of space in between the things. So I think another thing is called making these diagnoses and calling it names and making it sound like a disease. It doesn't deal with what the real issues might be. And I think the real issues are for young people. And I think it's really for the really young, because they're getting so involved in their social media that they are not relating to their families. They're not relating to their parents, their brothers, their sisters. And I think that's the biggest problem. And I've seen some very sad cases, as in my legal work in particular, of just how much our young people can get very disturbed. disturbed, and no one even sees it. No one knows how lonely they are, how much they're using drugs, or how anorexic they are, except the friends that they're communicating with, and they all have to promise not to talk to anybody. So I think it's an issue of being too isolated from family when you overuse these devices. But let's talk about what it's really about and not set up our kids for more diseases and more drugs.
That's a good point. Dr. Peter Breggin's called upon in courts to testify because of his background as a psychiatrist. One of his many books, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. Well, over the last month, numerous sightings of snake-shaped objects hovering in several places in the United States, from Wyoming to Texas, have prompted conspiracy theories about the government secretly spying on all of us. The Daily Star reports that the claims were fueled by reports about one of them hovering over Dallas, Texas. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hey, Stephen, what do we have?
Hello, George, and happy December to you and the listeners. You know, we begin with the sun, George. Quite interesting. This is from the fact book here. No sunspots on the visible disk of the sun for 256 days of this year. That equates to 76% of the year as extra proof that we are now going through one of the deepest solar minimums of all time. But looking at solar spacecraft, back on this date, George, in 1995, NASA launched the SOHO spacecraft, which, interestingly enough, is still providing great images of what's happening on our nearest star, the sun. And for those of you, George, out there that are looking into the sky, when you see the sun right now into the early morning sky, just know behind it, the sun is moving through what many describe as the 13th sign of the zodiac. What is that? It's a constellation known as Ophiuchus, and that indeed is something fascinating as we move into this period of time. We will give all the listeners, George, just a little sneak preview of some of the sky events that are happening in December, the last month. We'll find that the moon will reach its first quarter phase on the 4th, but an interesting conjunction, George, of both Venus and Saturn will happen on the 11th. This comes right after the beautiful Venus and Jupiter conjunction. On the 11th, look in the southwest after sunset. You'll find both of these planets within 2 degrees separation. On the 14th, George, we look at the Geminid meteor shower, and that occurs right after the beautiful full moon of December. We call it the beautiful full cold moon. Naturally, very apropos name for this time of year. And then, of course, common sense tells us that we reach in the northern hemisphere that particular winter solstice on the 22nd. And for lucky observers, George, that are on the other side of the Earth on the 26th, the day after Christmas, there'll be an annular eclipse of the sun where, of course, the moon is a little too small to make it a total eclipse. That occurs for observers in Saudi Arabia, southern India, Sumatra, Singapore, all the way out to Guam. If you're lucky enough to see it, it's great. And we wrap it up, George, with the live sky. The moon right now for observers as we move into Tuesday. Look for it tonight. It'll be nearly at its first quarter phase. A great time to look at really good detail between shadow and light along what we call the Terminator in telescopes and binoculars. Finally, for planets, that beautiful trio of planets, Venus, Jupiter, and Saturn, all visible low in the southwest. Dr. Sky naturally reminds everyone, especially during the holiday season, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. And email me at drskyshow@gmail.com. And check out these two great websites that we do a lot of research on, theskylive.com and wikisky.org. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Dr. Sky. We'll talk to you next week. As you know, we broadcast worldwide, and of course, we're on many radio stations in North America, including Canada, lots of them in Canada. In a moment, David Politis joins us, of course, one of our most sought-after guests. His latest work is called Missing 411 Canada, Unexplained Disappearances. Oh, get ready for this next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. David Politis back with us, has a professional background that includes 20-plus years in law enforcement and senior executive positions in the technology sector. Back in June of 2012, he was the invited speaker at the 2012 National Association of Search and Rescue's annual conference in South Lake Tahoe. The presentation was on the findings of the Can-Am project that were detailed in his original book, Missing 411. His latest work is called Missing 411 Canada. It is just as frightening as all the other Missing 411 books. And I had the pleasure a couple weeks ago of being with David in Little Rock, Arkansas at the Earthkeepers Convention. David, it was great seeing you there. You were swamped.
Oh, George, it was good to see you too. It was a really, really good crowd.
They love you. They love you out there. Not only were they packed in your conference room during your session, but you were out there with your books, and they were all over the place. It was great to see you, David.
Well, good to see you too, George. And I think the response has been favorable over the years, just because I'm dealing with just facts, and I think the public appreciates that.
I think so too. And it's scary, though. It really is, and it makes you wonder what's going on. Now, tell us how you keyed in on Canada on this latest work.
Well, Canada kind of came in around the back door. We were doing our second movie, Missing 411 Hunted, and we were doing some shoots at several different sites, and several people brought up stories out of Canada, just out of the blue. And the director, Mike DeGrazier, did a great job on the movie. We talked about it, and he said, you know, Dave, it sounds like there's some interest in Canada. You should probably look into it. And that kind of reinvigorated some investigations I did a couple years earlier. And I was sitting on a lot of cases from that country, and it kind of prompted me to do a little push on it. So it started maybe 18 months ago, and I finished it maybe a couple months ago. But it has intrigued to me as I started to dig into it, because as I've told the public before, the largest cluster of missing people in North America is Yosemite. And
that's right.
I know that surprises a lot of people, but doing the research, the second largest cluster in the world is the Greater Vancouver, British Columbia area.
That's scary.
When you dig into it, it is unbelievably disturbing how close to Vancouver it gets, very thick, very lush, and you're out in the woods quickly, and how many people are missing in these little small clusters around the city. And there's a female cluster, there's a couple of male clusters, and the one commonality to this that I think people need to understand, and as I've said in every interview I've done with you, that water plays a role in this. And that Vancouver area is just surrounded by lakes, rivers, and the ocean.
I got a couple Vancouver questions for you in a moment, but when you were last on with me in June, we were talking about Missing 411, The Hunted, when it came out. It zoomed, I'm told, to number one on iTunes International.
It went to number one twice, and according to the film distributor, he said that is almost unheard of, Dave. And we're very, very lucky. It's got stellar reviews on iTunes and Amazon, and it's really been appreciated. And I thank all the listeners out there that watched it. It's still doing really well.
Great, good for you. And that keys in on missing hunters, and you had interviews with law enforcement. You were out there yourself in that area. That's strange things going on, David.
Well, the thing about that movie that I think DeGrazier, the director, pulled out of it was we got these interviews with straight law enforcement and search and rescue personnel. So it's not me out there saying these things. It's them saying, you know, this was just bizarre. Why this guy traveled this amount of miles is unexplainable, or how this guy was able to get out of a 3-mile search grid, it doesn't make sense. And then you interview the families, and then you talk to friends and relatives. And I think it all kind of comes together at the end when Mike and I sat down and we talked about maybe 100 different stories from people about what they've encountered in the wilderness. And I get these stories all the time, the strange, the unusual. And we picked two stories where there was scientific basis behind the story to back up the allegations. And one was a series of recordings made in the 1970s by some hunters up in the Sierras. And those recordings, this is way before digital, you couldn't manipulate sounds. Those recordings were given to audio professors at two different universities who made some statements about those recordings that they were outside the range of human, they've never been heard, they aren't mammals of North America. It was just really strange. And then the second one dealt with a friend of yours, Bruce McAbee.
Great guy.
Great guy, one of the smartest men in the world that I know. He's a physicist, and one of his family members had a sighting in the woods, and it's what happened in conjunction with that sighting and what happened with the phone. The phone supposedly took a picture, and the engineer said, well, the phone took the picture, but the engineer said, but that's impossible that the phone did take that picture, because the way the software and the hardware is configured, it doesn't make sense because it can't do that, but it did it. So something really strange happened in those woods, and we played those two stories up at the end and got great reviews on it.
I got to tell you, too, David, Tim Conway, who hosts the local show on our affiliate in Los Angeles, KFI, right before I come on in that city, was talking about you tonight. And he's just in shock over these disappearances as well. Have you been following the stories of feet that wash ashore in British Columbia lately?
You know, that's funny you brought that up, because there is a section in the book about that. And I thought I should address it, because I've talked about it in years past. And the investigators and the coroners say, oh, you know, there's nothing here. You know, I think they're up to 19 different feet that have floated up.
The last one had a hiking boot on it.
Yeah, there you go. And they're kind of, they say, well, it's all explainable, but they never really identify whose feet these are or how they got there. And some said they were suicides. And they said, oh, this is just very common, the way the foot dislodges from the body in the water. So I spent maybe 2 weeks, and I scoured archives. And I could not find any place in the world where more than 2 feet ever floated up anywhere near a city. There was one in New York, there was one in Chicago, there was one in Boston. Never more than one. And that area around Vancouver, I think, has 19 to date.
That's crazy. I know we've tracked 14 of them so far, for sure. And it's bizarre. And I can't believe that people would commit suicide and that their foot would fall off. No, not that many people. It doesn't make sense. And is anybody reporting that their loved ones are gone? Are we hearing anything about that, David? Are you?
Well, that's part of the unusual nature of this, is that normally law enforcement is reluctant to say anyone is endangered for suicide. You almost never hear about that. They're reluctant to put that on the person in case they don't commit suicide, let's say. So they'll just say, oh, the person's missing under unusual circumstances, or the person is missing and endangered. That's another configured statement. But in reality, the RCMP is very closed-mouthed about this and a series of other things. And another one is the Highway of Tears up in northern British Columbia, where there's a series of Native American women who have disappeared over the last 35, 40 years. They've got a task force working on that for the last 10 years, and they still haven't arrested anybody, but they won't say much about it.
So let's get some high points over what you've seen overall with these missing people in Canada and elsewhere. What are some of the similarities that we have here, beginning with the dogs that try to track these missing people?
So, George, if I sat you down in a room with 50 search and rescue reports, and I asked you to read them, at the end of a couple hours, you'd come back and say, yeah, so what? You know, a lot of unusual things there. But if I gave you 10 years to study the topic and you read, say, between 5,000 and 7,000 reports, certain points would glean out to you as saying, oh, those are unusual. And what I started to do way back when was I started to put these stacks in my living room of unusual things. And one of the points that came out right away is that when they brought their canines or bloodhounds to the scene of a missing person, it was like a 99% on the cases that we've identified, the dog will either walk in a circle and lay down, or they'll walk up the trail 5 feet, turn around, and come back.
Jeez.
Now, when I was on the SWAT team, we had the canines assigned to us, and those dogs love to search. That behavior in a searching canine is not normal.
That's right. They're bred for searching.
Exactly. And in many of the conferences I've gone to, I've had handlers come up to me and go, Dave, nobody wants to talk about this, but it's happened to us. And it's very confusing, because that's normal. That's not normal behavior for the dog. And as long as there's a close proximity from the time the person disappears to the time the dog's on scene, there should be a real good scent trail to follow. Now, the other part of that is that in many of the search and rescues, they bring professional trackers to the scene. Now, in those instances where the canines can't track, trackers can't find evidence of anyone leaving the area, which is also
strange. It is strange. Now, do the dogs show any fear or anything like that? We'll talk about that and much more when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We will take your phone calls with David Politis next hour, but we've got lots of ground to cover as we talk about missing 411 Canada and all the just tragic and sad cases of missing people who have just merely vanished. It's unbelievable. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with David Politis. We're talking about his latest work, Missing 411 Canada. He also has a phenomenal movie out called Missing 411 The Hunted. David, before the break, I was about to ask you if the animals, the canines that are professionals at what they do for sensing, do they look scared? Do they, you know, run away?
You know, the dogs won't run away, but they will come right back to the master and the handler. And in fact, several stories directly from the search and rescue logs talk about the dog coming back and cowering between the handler's legs, which is not normal behavior. And when I've talked to handlers at conferences before, they said, yeah, this is, I found three where this has happened to them. And I think when you talked about me presenting at the search and rescue conference, these are things that search and rescue people don't like to talk about. And privately, they'll talk about it endlessly, but publicly they don't like to. And at several conferences I've been to, the people have stood up in the middle or at the end of the conference after I'm done talking, and they thank me for being somebody who's willing to break and talk the topic where most people won't. And in this one conference, these two Alaska State Troopers got up and actually said, hey, this happens more than people want to acknowledge. We found no bodies, we find no tracks, and we found no scent trail. And they said, finally, someone is willing to talk about this. And they said, hey, it's happening in Alaska. We'd like to know where else it's happening. And then we started to talk about the other states that I've written about.
Amazing. Let's talk about some possibilities, too. Let me throw some things your way, because though you're very hesitant in telling us over the years exactly what you think may be doing it, you do give us the possibilities of what's out there. Let me throw these your way and just tell me if they would be a possibility or not for these missing people. The first would be they're merely lost. They vanish. They wander off and they get lost. Possible?
So I think because the search and rescue is so fundamentally structured and thorough that I don't believe this is it. There's too many times where I've written about where the person disappears and the area is put into grids. And these grids are searched multiple times, sometimes with dogs. Lots of times searchers walking shoulder to shoulder. And they don't find anything. And then on the eighth or ninth day, they're about ready to pull out. All of a sudden, the body shows up in the middle of the grid where they've searched it multiple times. This makes no sense. And in fact, it's one of those profile points found in an area previously searched. How the person got there, how they were missed. See, I don't think search and rescue missed them. I think somehow they just arrived back.
After the fact.
Correct.
Yep. Abducted by some person, some serial killer, some sicko out there in the woods.
Again, I think the scent trail would be there. I know that tracks leaving the area would be there.
Yep.
People have asked me this before. I know in Colorado, I'm in the mountains all the time. I'm one of those guys who carry a gun wherever I go in the mountains. And if something like this happened, I know that there's a large percentage of people in the mountains where I hike that carry guns. You know, there'd be an abductor that was dead.
Abducted by a UFO.
So that's been brought up to me hundreds of times. I talk at MUFON conferences all the time, and people bring this up to me all the time. It's not something that I can decline and something I can assume does happen, because most of the time there's something evidentiary that's left behind. But the weird part about the people in the cases I write about, when they're interviewed post-disappearance by the search and rescue people and by law enforcement, they can't remember how they got lost and how they made their way back. And in a large percentage of the cases, this is the weird part, is that there's no cause of death in the victims.
That is bizarre.
Now, when I first started to write about this in my third book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence, I had a series of coroners write to me and talk to me. And in fact, I met with two of them. And they said, Dave, we have 9 different coroners that work out of this office, and we regularly have meetings. And we run into this you know, every quarter, every 3 or 4 months. And he says, it's bizarre. And he said, we don't understand it. We're men of science, ladies of science, and we can't figure this out. Something really odd is happening because people just don't die for any reason. There's always a reason, and we can't figure that out.
Jeez. Next possibility, they're snatched by an animal or a Bigfoot-type creature.
So one of the issues that we do in all of the cases before I'll take them on to investigate them is go through this vetting process. First of all, it's animal predation. So if you go online and you pull the filters off Google or Yahoo and you put in animal predation and look at images, the scene is grotesque. There's blood, there's torn clothing, there's marks across the ground where bodies are dragged. It's an unmistakable scene that someone's been attacked by an animal. You cannot miss it.
You can't. There's blood everywhere. It's a mess.
Exactly. And when people are attacked, especially near others, they'll scream and they'll yell. And a lot of the cases I write about, the parents say, my child was right there, meaning very close to them. And they said, we didn't hear a sound. We didn't hear anything. Well, let's just say a mountain lion jumped a little boy. They'd be screaming and yelling, and everyone would know.
You'd hear the lion. You'd hear the little boy. It would be just horrible.
Exactly. So that's animal predation. If there's any mental health issues, we won't work it. Coupled with voluntary disappearance, if somebody just wants to, even an adult, just wants to run away from their spouse.
And check out. Yeah. That's right.
Right. It's not against the law. But we won't work that. And then if there's any evidence of criminal activity, and this is something that search and rescue looks for, this is what the law enforcement people on scene also look for, is there's something criminal that took place in those mountains. Did the hunter's partner kill him? Did something happen in the mountains they don't understand? Well, if that was the case, it would be in the reports. And in all my years of doing this, there's only a couple of times where I ever saw that there was something criminal and people were later arrested for it. But any evidence of criminality, we won't work it either. So there's that vetting process that you're looking for to exclude anything that may be a match.
Suicide, of course, they'd end up finding the body somewhere, wouldn't they, generally?
Generally, yes, that's true. I mean, a lot of times that's a spur-of-the-moment thing, and other times people really want to go into the backcountry, and there are those instances where they never do find a body.
Right.
And they know it's suicide because they left a note.
That does happen. That's true. Here's my favorite. They are somehow stumbling into a portal or another dimension, never to be seen again.
That's an interesting one, George. And since I'm a man of science, I believe that we should look into all of these possibilities. Now, I made a 2-hour special for the History Channel called Vanished. You can watch it on Amazon right now, I think. And they sent me to Madison, Wisconsin, and I met with a physicist, John Brandenburg. And
he's been on the show. Good guy. Good guy.
Really good guy.
Yeah.
We were at his lab at the university, and we were talking through all these different things. And he said, Dave, he says, people don't understand this, but portals are real. He said, there's five or six physicists that regularly get together, and we talk these things through. And there's a couple of them that are working for other countries trying to weaponize a portal. And what I asked him off camera, and I don't know why this never made the show, but I said, so could portals be directed? That's the million-dollar question, Dave.
Interesting.
And I think this is the important part, George, is that when a small child is near a parent and the parent doesn't see or hear or smell anything and the child disappears, how can that happen without leaving tracks, drag marks?
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. That's why I think the portal possibility may be the biggest or the best.
Well, Brandenburg said, Dave, 100% they're factual. He said, and just as a side note, Brandenburg now works for NASA. So
that's right.
He's super credible. And he said, he goes, all of the cutting-edge theoretical physicists in the world talk about this all the time. And he goes, I can't tell you more about it because we don't understand a lot about it. But he goes, what you're saying, Dave, is probable. And then, George, I think I've told you this before, but I have a lot of interesting stories that are told to me by people in the woods. And one was told to me about 3 years ago by a hunter here in Colorado. And he was hunting up at 11,000 feet in a meadow. And he kind of had his head down. He said, and he was getting tired walking back to his car. going down a trail, and he kind of saw a fog bank or something up in front of him, so he kind of pulled his head up and looked, and he said it was strange. He goes, I kept walking closer to it, and it didn't look like a fog bank. It almost looked like a sheet of glass. And he said he slowed down as he got close to it, and he goes, darn, if it didn't look like glass, but it also looked like fog. So he picked his foot up, and he put his foot partially through it, and he said, Dave, my foot went through, and the part that went through, I couldn't see it.
Wow. Like a Twilight Zone movie where you put your hand in the other dimension.
And this guy, he works in law enforcement, super credible. And he said, Dave, I turn around, and I literally ran from there because there was something not right.
Well, we've just gone through seven scenarios. Are there any others that I'm missing?
Oh, I think you've hit all the biggies, George, and those are, I mean, every once in a while, I do get one where people think it's the government, and I don't think that's so obscene.
But even if it is, how are they taking them?
Well, that's a good point. And when I, in my talks with Brandenburg, he said, you know, Dave, he said, we talked about all kinds of things for 3 hours, but he was talking about Star Trek. And he says, you know, the transponders that move people point to point. He said, Dave, I think, he goes, we're not far away from being able to do that now in conventional physics. But he said, who knows if we may be 50 years ahead in another group with advanced science that could do it right now. And when you talk about that theoretical physics, if they could manipulate the human genome like that and move it place to place, then it could say that our government could be doing this.
Well, let's go back to the portal dimensional theory for just a moment. And that is, if they go through these, where do they go to? It's all a speculation. And are they still alive, or what happens to them? I mean, have they landed in another place where they can eat and, you know, be merry and just simply say, oh, my God, I can't find my way back?
So when Skinwalker Ranch was going, and the National Institute of Discovery Sciences had their people on scene with a series of retired FBI agents.
And our buddy George Knapp was all over that story.
Right. They saw a window frame open up on the horizon, something jump out of the window frame down onto the meadow and run away. The window frame closes, and the atmosphere and the sky is back to the way it was normally. So in my conversations with Brandenburg, I said, well, is that a portal, or what is that? He says, that's a good question, Dave. What was that? But he goes, we've heard those stories hundreds of times from other people. So what could that be?
Bizarre. And, you know, you just mentioned something about directional portals, if you can direct them. What if there are beings, some kind of beings, in these other dimensions, and they're grabbing these people for whatever reason through these directional portals? Let's pick up this kid. Let's pick up this guy. Let's pick up this woman. And they aim this portal to them, and they stumble into it, and they keep them.
Well, I remember John Mack, the psychiatrist from Harvard University.
God rest his soul.
Oh, he was a great guy. And he did research into abductions. And Dr. Mack came back with the reality statement that, hey, these are real. These people are going through something that the general public doesn't want to acknowledge. And he almost lost his tenure at Harvard because he attacked a very unconventional topic very conventionally. So I think that all these things, George, are kind of open game until somebody with great knowledge beyond us comes forward and explains how it's being done.
David, let's talk about Missing 411 Canada. We'll talk about it again next hour, and we'll take some phone calls with you, too, as people are just fascinated with this subject. What did you conclude? What have you discovered about Canada, specifically the British Columbia, Vancouver area?
So within an 80-mile radius of downtown Vancouver, there's more than 30 people that have disappeared in various clusters in that region. And there's one specific mountain that we'll talk about next hour that is 10 miles from downtown Vancouver. And there's been a series of disappearances there over the years on a 4,000-foot mountaintop that is completely unexplainable. And the frustration of search and rescue, not finding any clothing, bodies, water jugs, nothing to explain how the people literally vanished into nothingness. And it's just not that one location, but there's multiple. And since this book originally came out, which this tonight is the actual release date of it, George, is I put some early releases out to some friends up in that area. And all of those people have stated that the number of people missing outside of that general Vancouver area is something nobody wants to talk about, nobody wants to acknowledge. And as I was talking to a friend, Randy Breeson, 2 days ago, he was out in the field yesterday searching for an older man who disappeared just outside of Maple Ridge, British Columbia, and he wasn't found.
Jeez, it's just so bizarre. It truly is. Now, these 30 people that are missing in the Vancouver area, over what period of time, David?
So we have cases that match the profiles going back to the 1940s and 1950s, going all the way up until within days ago. But when I go through them with you, it'll just be bizarre. Here's one quick example: is the Olympic Peninsula of Washington. The water, it's called the Strait of the Juan de Fuca, between the Olympic National Park area and Vancouver Island. There's a series of little boys that are disappeared on the coast of the Olympics in the last 30, 40 years. On the other side of that water, on Vancouver Island, there's a series of young boys and men that have disappeared also. It's never women. It's always young boys and young men. And the only thing that separates this is this body of water called the Strait of the Juan de Fuca. And the way I figured this out is I started mapping all the disappearances. And in this book, you get a 24 by 36 inch geographical cluster map of British Columbia showing all of these disappearances. And really, once you see it on a map, George, it's even more uncomfortable.
It's bizarre when you see it. You sent me a huge map, David, with the book. And you look at it, and I unfolded the thing, and it's like looking at a movie where the law enforcement puts little pins where everybody's missing, and it's very bizarre.
Well, talking to my friends up in British Columbia, they said the news doesn't like talking about this, law enforcement doesn't like talking about it, and nobody has ever put together the entirety of the disappearances in the area like this. And I'm not even claiming that I've uncovered them all, because I can guarantee I haven't. It's only been a real strict and heavy archive search that I've been able to find what I have. But just like in the United States, the RCMP doesn't want to talk about this.
Why don't they want to talk about it? What are they afraid of?
So in general, law enforcement doesn't like to discuss what they don't have answers for.
That's a good point. You just hit it right on the head there. David, we're going to take a quick break. We will come back and talk about more Vancouver disappearances. And I assume that mountaintop you're talking about is Mount Seymour, but we'll get into that. Missing 411 Canada is David Politis' book. And, of course, his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.